Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for the dawn of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, no comparison, and what I think now is the fourth week running, no intro music. This is Banal of America Audio Season 8 Live, episode number 832. So we're coming down the home stretch of Season 8, and tonight's program is going to delve into the mystery of cattle mutilations, which is a topic we have not covered on the program in depth ever, which is really surprising. I'm sure we've danced around it and touched on it and on occasion mentioned it, maybe even spent 5 or 10 minutes on it, but we've never really looked at cattle mutilations with the microscope of BOA Audio, and that's what we're going to do tonight. Our guest is Christopher O'Brien. He was previously on the show to talk about his book, Stalking the Trickster, and now this time around he's Stalking the Herd, which is his new book, Stalking the Herd, Unraveling the Cattle Mutilation Mystery. This thing's massive, folks. I have the e-copy. Otherwise, I like with the big books, I have to slam them on the desk so people can hear how powerful they are. But if I did that, I'd break my iPad. Yeah. So it's monstrous, yeah, though, and that's a good descriptor for a book on cattle mutilations. But it's monstrously in-depth. It's definitive, for sure. So I'm looking forward to talking to him. Welcome back to the show, Chris. It's going to be, a fun and enlightening conversation here tonight.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thanks, Tim. The actual copy of the book, the hard copy of it, is almost 2 pounds. It's like, oh, my God. And I took 300 pages out, and it's still 600 pages.
Oh, my God. Jeez.
Yeah. Well, I'm
so it really
I'm
would have been like
a follow-up
almost 1,000 pages.
Yeah. Yeah,
wow.
I'm already working on a follow-up book, which analyzes this book.
Wow.
I guess I'll have to call it Stalking the Stalkers.
Yeah, that's
to
meta.
To kind of go with the trilogy.
That's meta. What is that? Now, I was going to ask you about that to completely break the fourth wall. What's the Stalking the Trickster and then Stalking the Herd? Is that intentional? I presume it had to have dawned on you. So what's the theme there?
Well, you know, I've always envisioned my writing in trilogies. The first two books kind of lay out the data, and then the third book, rather, kind of sums it all up, cherry picks the best cases, and analyzes, the first two books. So, you know, The Mysterious Valley, Enter the Valley, was kind of summed up in Secrets of the Mysterious Valley, and then Stalking the Tricksters, Stalking the Herd, and Stalking the Stalkers is looking at a tricksterish element, basically, that's inherent, I think, in all aspects of the paranormal and, these mysterious things that we talk about on your show and my show, the Paracast. And I'm working with, I think, in my estimation, the most creative, most intelligent thinker in the field, David Perkins. He has a master's from Yale University. He's been my mentor for over 20 years. He was absolutely invaluable in helping research Stalking the Herd. He's been involved in the cattle mutilation mystery since 75. He could be called the grandfather of mutology. I'm not sure if he particularly liked that label, but he is. He knows more about this than anybody, including myself. And I'm going to be co-authoring the follow-up book to Stalking the Herd with David Perkins. It really has to be done. Somebody has to analyze all this data that we have and that I present in Stalking the Herd. It is filled with more more data about this particular mystery than I think most people can handle. It's just so overwhelming. It really is. It overwhelms me, and I was the one that wrote the darn thing.
Well, what do you think can be gained from synthesizing the data? Try to find some kind of pattern or something like that?
Right, yeah. We're going to be looking for patterns, looking for agendas, identifying players, really attempting to, it's like throwing mud against a wall, and whatever sticks, it's almost Occam's razor, whatever sticks is what you got to go with. And because this is so complicated, this subject is so complicated that it really deserves a serious analytical, treatment. And stalking the herd basically is presenting all the data to the best of my ability, dovetailing together and coalescing together up to 12 different databases. I've been in contact over 20 years with most of the movers and shakers that have ebbed and flowed throughout this this investigative process that began back in the 60s, really. And I really was well positioned to be able to distill all these databases together in a way that nobody's attempted to do before. And until you really have all the data in one place and you can really look at it, it's impossible to analyze it. So now that we have all the data in one place, we're going to take our best shot at really attempting to completely unravel the cattle mutilation mystery, if that's even possible.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure it's possible, but we're going to give it a shot.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I guess let's catch the folks up to speed, I guess, for the folks, because
right.
Cattle mutilations have kind of slipped into the background of the whole paranormal milieu in the last, 15, 20 years or something like that. So I guess let's start sort of and catch them up to speed a little bit, sort of define cattle mutilations for them, tell them a little bit about how it all sort of burst onto the scene a little bit, and we'll kind of trace the evolution of this mystery as we know it.
Well, humans have been raising and domesticating animals for thousands of years, and throughout that time period, there have been outbreaks from the 1600s, basically, onward that are documented of all kinds of livestock that have been found in a mutilated condition. And by that, I mean an animal that's dead for no apparent reason, missing various soft tissue organs. Generally, it's the reproductive organs. In a female animal, the rear end has been cored out, the reproductive tract has been cored out, like a plug has been pulled out. On the male animals, the external genitalia is gone. Oftentimes an eye or an ear is missing. There'd be a patch of flesh that appears to have been expertly excised off the animal. A classic mutilation is generally a cow that has those, disfigurements, for lack of a better term. But also the flesh on the jawbone has been, it looks like, been expertly pulled off, sliced off, and then removed. And the tongue has gone deep within the esophagus. And that to me is the classic mutilation. When you see that
okay.
bleached white jawbone and that tongue is gone from deep within the throat, that's very, very difficult to explain. Veterinary pathologists have attempted at times over the years to duplicate some of these surgeries, and they've been able to do it, but with great difficulty under lab conditions with lights, not out in the field in the dark,
sculpting
around. This is a mystery that's been around for a long time. I was able to finally get the earliest documentation of a case that occurred in 1605 and 1606 around London during the reign of James the First, and we do have an official, statement within the court of James records pertaining to hundreds of sheep that were discovered mutilated in the shires around London. And the last sentence of the entry is very, very intriguing to me. It says, of these things, sundry conjectures can be made, but most tendeth to agree, something about fireworks. If you want, I can read you the actual quote, but it tendeth toward fireworks is how the quote ends here. It's, while slaughters of sheep have been made in some places to number 100, in others less, where nothing is taken from the sheep but the tallow and some inward parts, whole carcasses and the fleece remaining still behind. Of this sundry conjectures, but most agree that it tendeth toward fireworks. Now, if that's not an intriguing description,
yeah,
that's
weird.
What that is. Yeah. Well, you know, when I look at these animal death cases, which really peaked in the 1970s, where hundreds and hundreds of animals were being reported in 18 states around the West. It was the AP story of the year in Colorado in 75. Law enforcement was chasing around. Ranchers had vigilante groups set up, pickup truck loads of armed guys were running around, shooting at helicopters. It really was, a major deal in the Midwest and in the West in the 70s. But since then, many of these cases are not being covered in the media, and these cases are still occurring. In fact, we had 7 animals mutilated in the end of August during the supermoon in Huerfano County in southern Colorado. So these cases are still occurring. Also down in South America, there have been thousands of cases that have been reported since 2002, right at the end of a major outbreak of foot and mouth disease in the cattle herds down there, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, Paraguay. Hundreds and hundreds of animals were reported. One case featured a 60,000-gallon stock tank drained completely of water with no evidence that the water had ever been there or no water around the tank, and 19 mutilated animals were placed inside the empty stock tank.
What?
These cases are not – yes, these cases are not
being
covered
in
the
media. That's weird, man. Jesus. So I'm sorry. Sorry to interrupt you there. That's just – who's what the hell? What? How do these things get stuffed in there? That's crazy.
Well, yeah, there's real good documentation on that one. That was not the only one. There were, I think, one or two other cases where animals were found mutilated within empty stock tanks. That, how do you drain 60,000 gallons of water in a matter of a few hours and leave no evidence of how it was done? That would have created a huge mud puddle outside the tank if it had, just been. If they just opened up the tap on the tank and let it all drain out, I mean, it would take hours for that to drain. But to put the animals in the tank, the empty tank, it didn't have a lid on it. Well, it would be what's the motivation? So when I wrote Stalking the Tricksters, it was based on the tricksterish elements that I discovered while attempting early on in the early 90s to investigate cattle mutilations. And I kept bumping up against this like trickster kind of energy or a mechanism that we talked about when I was on your show last. And this is taking that and applying that trickster kind of element to the cattle mutilation phenomenon. This is an incredibly dense. It's like a Gordian knot. And what I've attempted to do with this book is place all this data in one place so that we can at least have it there to look at. Obviously, garbage in, garbage out. I understand that. And as soon as the media gets involved generally, any dead cow that looks strange to the amateur eye is going to be reported as mutilated or most of these cases that are media-induced, let's say, are by and large, I think, sort of unusual-looking scavenger action. The debunkers, of course, and the skeptics say that there is no such thing as a cattle mutilation or unexplained livestock death. This is all just predation and or scavenger action. I had one researcher tell me, oh, it's vultures. They actually kill the cows, and then they disfigure them and leave these surgical incisions and all this. And, I've seen magpies actually carve out the rear end of a cow in a perfect circle. I mean, there are a lot of cases that are misidentified as mutilations that they're just mundane, strange-looking, but mundane scavenger action. And usually when the media gets involved regionally or nationally, then everybody's always, they're out looking around and they've got their eyes open for dead livestock. And if they see what they don't understand as scavenger action, they report it as a mutilation. So you have all this kind of, muddying up of the waters. It's very difficult to cut through that. And I think in this book, what I've done is I've highlighted the cases, and there's well over 1,000, probably several thousand cases that I've highlighted that have unusual elements that fly in the face of a mundane scavenger action, debunking sort of offhand dismissal. And there's so much evidence. I mean, we've found nicotine, mescaline, anticoagulants, ketamine, all sorts of tranquilizing agents, barbiturates, poisons, all sorts of chemical agents have been found within some of these mutilated animals. Animals have been discovered with one pregnant cow, for instance, was autopsied, and they broke into the womb and they found that the unborn fetus had been mutilated. You know, what's the motivation there, and how do you do that? So obviously we're dealing with something that needs to, you know, you need to put all this information in one place so that it can be scrutinized and analyzed properly. Anything less than that, it's just going to be, you know, playing into the debunkers' hands, and they're just going to dismiss all this as nothing but media-induced hysteria. And boy, I'll tell you, after you read the book, you're going to walk away scratching your head going, well, there's definitely something going on, but who's responsible and why they're doing it? You know, that's open to interpretation. You know, I often joke in my lectures, you know, for every type of scenario or culprit or answer that you come up with, if I take the opposite side and argue against that, I'll win, because there's just enough data to support, you know, scavenger action that the debunkers say, you know, occultists, you know, ritual blood sacrifice, military experimentation for various reasons, you know, ETs coming down to do this. For each one of those possible explanations, there's enough data to support it, but there's way more data to refute it. So what does that leave you with? It leaves you with multiple groups involved with multiple agendas, piggybacking their agendas on top of one another, creating this Gordian knot of plausible deniability. And it's ingenious the way the whole thing has been set up. And I think this book is really, you know, it should have been written 20 or 30 years ago by somebody. And, you know, I just happened to, unfortunately, signed the contract to write the book, and about a week after I did, I said, what did I do? Oh, my God, you know, and 18 months later, you know, I was banging my head against the wall going, why did you sign that contract? But I knew I was going to do it at some point. So there you go. Here we are, and there you go.
Yeah. Well, it's a very complex mystery, as you said. You kind of hit on the four big theories of what this thing is. You know, aliens, cultists, government, secret government stuff, or just natural phenomena.
Right.
That seems to be the big four reasonings behind all this. It's very weird, though, because like you said, it's kind of like, in a way, like the UFO phenomenon, where once you try to pin it on one thing, there's all these other possibilities that come up, where you're like, oh, wait, it can't be that because the case is X, Y, and Z. So it's very confusing. Now, how did this whole thing... You know, you say you have some cases way back in history, but how did this whole thing burst sort of into the consciousness of the paranormal field? Like you said earlier, that your friend Perkins is the father or the grandfather of what did you mutology, right? Is what you call it.
Mutology.
Yeah. So I guess, like, take me through the history of mutology. How did this all begin? How did these people even sort of realize that this was happening?
That's really interesting, because the first major case that it received international attention was the Snippy the Horse case in about, you know, 40 miles from where I lived for 13 years in Colorado. This was in first week of September 1967. This horse was discovered. We've never had a case before or since like it, but the case featured a horse found dead for no apparent reason. It had been alive just the day, you know, the day before. It was discovered missing all the tissue, the muscle, the hide, the meat from the tip of its nose to all the way around like its collar. So the neck and skull were totally denuded of all flesh. And the upper organs, the respiratory organs, the heart was pulled out with no apparent way to get through the ribcage and all that. The brain was gone with a brain case. And the bones were bleached white, like they'd been in the sun for 30 years, quote unquote. This became an international news story, and it calls from China, France, South America, all over Europe were made to the ranch, you know, the rancher family. They initially tried to kind of cover it up. They didn't really want people to know about it, but word got out. People started tramping out there to the site, and, you know, then the press, about a month after the case, the press picked up on it, and it hit the wire services and became an international news story. Well, the day before, Nellie Lewis, the owner of the horse, her mother was doing the dishes in the ranch house, and she had what she thought was like a UFO sighting right outside the window over the corral, and there was a big silvery object out there. She didn't have her glasses on, so she couldn't see details, but it was, you know, apparent that something was, you know, actually it lopped off the top of the corner of a fence post on the corral. And so the owner of the horse made the, you know, understandable leap that, and this is one of the headlines that was featured, that flying saucers killed my horse. When I was 10 years old, I remember seeing the Inquirer, whatever, you know, of the, you know, 1967 Inquirer type magazine at the supermarket, and had a picture of this horse lying on the ground, people looking at it, and flying saucers killed my horse. And of course, as being a little kid with, you know, my own personal experience when I was 6 or 7, you know, I really just ate it up, and I read that article before I even got home from the store with my mom. And so that's how I found out about the phenomenon to begin with, as a 10-year-old, and knew about the San Luis Valley where it happened, and knew about Snippy. But it wasn't until really the 70s where hundreds and hundreds of cases started being reported all over the Midwest, all over the Rocky Mountain region. We have as many as 8 states hit in a single night at the height of this in October of 75. And this is when, you know, people started reporting weird lights out in their pastures. They started reporting, you know, stuff that couldn't be explained with a conventional explanation. Many hundreds of helicopter sightings over the years have been logged by ranchers, you know, that have had their cattle victimized, if you will. So we have this weird kind of aerial component that's been involved. Strange lights. There have been very, very few cases, just a handful of cases that feature any sort of ETs or real obvious structured craft. Of course, Linda Moulton Howe has kept this subject alive for many years in her own way, but with an agenda to, you know, to put the whole blame on aliens. And there's way more data to support, you know, some sort of government possible scenario, let's say, or there's evidence to suggest that even some of these cases have to do with ritual magic. There's cases where rich ranchers are doing mutilation cases to their neighbors to try to drive them out of business and appropriate their ranch land. There's a number of very compelling cases like that. 70% of the ranches that were in operation at the height of the number of cattle in this country, we had more cattle in the United States in 1975, and that was also the height of meat consumption in the United States. Since then, it's almost halved since then in terms of how much meat a person eats on average per year, and how many cattle head of cattle are actually on the in the environment in North America. This has almost gone down about 40% since 75. But what's really compelling to me is 70 to 80% of the ranching operations that were in business in 75 are now out of business. And instead, we have these huge feedlots with tens and thousands of animals all stuffed together, and these rendering plants. Factory farming. And interestingly enough, many of the areas of highest incidence of cattle mutilations in the 70s are now where you have these factory, these huge industrialized factory operations. So I think there's some sort of connecting point there, which I do go into in the book. And also, you know, we have the emergence of transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, which is, of course, mad cow disease in cattle, scrapie in sheep, chronic wasting disease in deer and elk, Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease in humans. We have our first indications that TSE, transmissible spongiform encephalopathy, has, you know, emerges in the environment around the time of Snippy in 67, and then it kind of goes away, and then it starts to come back. And by the mid-80s in England, of course, you know, they ended up having a huge wave of mad cow disease before they even knew what it was. They didn't even know that prions, these misfolded proteins, were responsible for creating mad cow disease. At the time, they didn't know. But because they were so afraid of this disease, which is 100% fatal, by the way, makes AIDS and Ebola look like a bad cold. before they were even aware of what was causing this, they ended up culling the entire herds. Every head of livestock in the United Kingdom was slaughtered and then cremated, it started in 86. It ended in about 98. So it was about a 10, 12-year period where Mad Cow swept through the United Kingdom. And by the end of it, the only thing that they could do was kill all the cows. Well, at the time, they didn't realize that prions can survive up to 2,500 to 3,000 degree heat. Well, they were, you know, cremating these animals at about 1,000 degrees. So, yeah. You know, all that bone ash, you know, which went into a lot of fertilizer that was sent around the world, you know, there was a lot of, you know, active prions.
Oh, God,
in
they never
bones.
Really got rid of it anyway, yeah. Jesus.
So, I mean, this whole thing is so involved. There's so many permutations. There's so many possible agendas. There's so much smoking gun evidence to point the finger around. And what I've attempted to do with Stalking the Herd is at least present as objectively as possible, not throw any data out, not factor anything in, be as objective and as intellectually honest as I can be, and present the data. And in the second book, we're going to analyze the data, but there was so much data, I could barely get it into a 600-page book, and it's small type, and it's single-spaced.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Now, did you mentioned Latin America. Do we know about these cattle mutilations in anywhere other than the U.S. and Latin America? Because, like you talk about this mad cow outburst, you would think that if there was some kind of connection between trying to get to the bottom of diseased cows and surreptitious government work, clandestine projects or whatever, that certainly they would want to dig into those mad English cows. So do we know anything? Have we seen this kind of thing pop up anywhere else? You know, Russia and China are big countries. You'd think that we'd see stuff there.
Yeah, we have. Basically, the rule of thumb is if it's a Christian country, chances are you're going to have cattle mutilation reports. And I think I'm the first one to really point that out, that these cases almost exclusively occur in Christian countries. And I think that's maybe a very telling statistic. Another statistic that I find very compelling is the fact that India, of course, in India, they worship cows. Cows are allowed to wander anywhere they want. It's you know, one of the worst crimes you can do to kill a cow in India. If a cow wants to go into your house, you have to let it. It's good luck to feed one of these cows just wandering around. India is the largest exporter of beef. Did you know that?
No. I don't understand how they can do that.
Well, they don't eat them, so they sell them.
Oh, my God. That's weird.
Yeah, and the sacred cow of India is what? What breed? The Brahma, right? The Brahma cow, the white sacred cows of India. Well, every type of cow that you can possibly put your finger on has been discovered in a mutilated condition. Most of the cows are hybrids of a mixture of bloodlines and breeds. I have yet to find a single case of a Brahma cow, bull, or steer that's been mutilated anywhere.
Well,
that.
So what you're saying is that India is behind all this. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just joking.
No, I'm not saying that, but maybe they are.
We've cracked the mystery here on the show, folks.
Yeah,
really. India, secret government of India is doing something to our
cows. I get it. Okay. Hey, this is all cowboys and Indians.
Oh, there you go. Wow. That's strange, though. That's really weird. I didn't even know that they exported so much. So we do know that this stuff is going on in other countries, I guess?
Out of its buffalo. We've had cases of mutilated seals in the Orkney Islands, all these seals washing up with the identical mutilation marks. A pod of 50 dolphins were discovered in the south of France mutilated. We've had mutilated dolphins along the Gulf Coast. Thousands and thousands of domesticated cats have been discovered cut in half, like clipped with a giant pair of scissors in most of your urban areas in the West. We've had pigs, sheep, deer, elk, humans. I even had a case of a chipmunk mutilation, believe it or not. I had a case of a coyote mutilation that was lying next to a mutilated cow. So any warm-blooded animal, basically, in a Christian country, has been discovered in a mutilated condition. That's a bit of a generality, but I think it's almost totally accurate. So most of the cases are cattle. A second on the list would probably be horses, followed, you know, closely by sheep and pigs. What I find interesting is when I really started researching back how particular memes began, you know, the memes of who's responsible, you know, tracing back the occultist theory, tracing back the alien theory, I came up with some very interesting revelations. For instance, the mutilation phenomenon didn't really become, you know, a big meme in the culture until 74, 75. But in 71, you had a rash of hundreds and hundreds of pigs being stolen in Iowa and in parts of the Midwest, and tons of helicopter sightings in conjunction with stolen swine. And it got so bad that vigilante groups were being formed, and gun battles occurred between helicopter crews and ranchers trying to protect their pigs and their livestock. In one case, gunfire was even taken by the rancher from a team on the ground, and plus being fired at by helicopter crews. And so in 71, what we have is a bunch of rustling going on in the Midwest. It's almost like they hadn't really figured out that if they leave the animals there, they have plausible deniability. So they were stealing them. And this, of course, generates law enforcement reports, official investigations. It really gets ranchers, ire up, and they start forming vigilante groups and start patrolling around. And lots of guns are being, toted around. So that approach evidently didn't work, because in 72, we don't have a single mutilation case.
Oh.
Not a single one. The only unusual animal death case that I can find was a bunch of caribou up in Alaska.
Strange.
And then, 72, we have these rustling cases happening and lots of helicopter reports. And then in 73, wherever there were helicopter reports, you don't have any reports of UFOs in the huge wave of UFO sightings that happened in the Midwest and the Southeast United States in 73, one of the largest waves on record. But those UFO reports were all in areas that didn't feature helicopter reports and rustling the year, in the years prior. So there's some interesting kind of trends in the data, if you will, that I look at and kind of go into some depth in attempting to analyze that. So it wasn't really until 73, at the end of 73, beginning of 74, and then definitely it goes full speed from 75 through 80. I mean, thousands of animals were reported to law enforcement, to newspapers, to political figures, to ranching associations, livestock boards. It just went quantum. And the chapters in the book on the waves of the 70s are just voluminous. I mean, there's so many good quality cases, and I had nowhere near the room to devote to really put all the cases in there. I picked out the cases that had unusual elements that you can't explain away as predator action. Factoring anything out, I'm not saying it's not ETs. I'm not saying it's not the government. I'm not saying it's not cultists. I'm just putting the data out there and looking for trends, looking for the types of connecting data that will give us some sort of insight on what the motivations could be to do this, number one, and number two, who is responsible. And the fact that nobody's ever been, charged or convicted of a cattle mutilation since 1902, when somebody was in England, and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle got him off after he'd been sentenced and was in jail. He was a horse slasher convicted of a cattle mutilation, according to Charles Fort, which I find very interesting. Just like Snippy the Horse is considered the first cattle mutilation, and it was a horse. So you have some weird themes and this weird kind of juxtaposition of cow and horse. And, we haven't even talked about the domestication of cattle that began, 10,500 B.C., 80 animals have basically been, they've done a genetic test of cattle around the world, and they all boil down to a single herd in northern Iran from 10,500 B.C. You have 940-something breeds of cattle now. There's 1.37 billion cattle on the planet. They're the largest source of fresh water. They're the single biggest reason why they're cutting down the rainforest to make more grazing land for cows. Cattle are The Indians, when they first encountered cattle, North American Indians, Native Americans, referred to them as hooved locusts because they were so detrimental to the environment. And, they're the largest source of the creation of deserts on the planet. Of course, we all know where anthrax comes from. We all are familiar with, hopefully with mad cow disease and the possible health implications of that particular scourge. So, the book really starts 30,000 years ago with the first cave paintings of cattle all the way to literally a couple of weeks before the book was turned into the publisher. We had a case in southwestern Nebraska where a mutilated cow was found with its head in a hole in the pasture. A very bizarre case. Again, it's a huge subject. There's so many implications for human health, for the environment, for the sanctity of these animals. We worshipped cattle for thousands of years. The bull and the cow, even to this day in India, the cow is revered. But I trace the progression of religious belief and the sanctity and the reverence for cattle. I trace it forward through history. And back then they were systematically slaughtered, but with very, very devout religious intention. Now we ritualistically slaughter them unceremoniously, 400 an hour in some of the larger rendering plants. And because we're cramming all these cows together, in feedlots, obviously they're in very unsanitary conditions, so we have to pump them full of antibiotics. 80% of the antibiotics used in this country go into cattle. And to get them out of the feedlot and get them fat faster and get them, to the weight that they need to slaughter them, we pump them full of growth hormones. And so most of your growth hormones used in this country go into cattle to get them out of the feedlot and out of the unsanitary conditions. So, this really opens up a huge ball of wax. It opens up the whole power of the beef industry in this country. It's one of the most powerful lobbies in this country you will never hear about. Unless you're Oprah and you say you'll never eat another hamburger again and you're slapped immediately with a $2 billion. I eat meat. I love beef. I don't eat it very often, but when I do, I know where it comes from. It's grass-fed. It's local. It doesn't have hormones in it. It's not pumped full of grain like they do in feedlots. Cattle really aren't designed to eat grain, but if you pump them full of 1,700 pounds of grain, you can put 400 pounds of weight on an animal. And if you put a bunch of growth hormones in there, you can get it out of the feedlot quicker. It'll grow faster. These are all, I think, issues that are really not addressed when you talk about the cattle mutilation phenomenon. It opens up this cultural closet that most of us don't want to go into. We don't want to know that when we go to a fast food restaurant, up to 1,000 different animals' meat could be in one hamburger. That's scary to me.
Yeah, that's crazy, really scary stuff. But you're right, because there's two things going on here. You've got the mystery of cattle mutilations, and then if you just hone in on just the cattle part, you've got a whole mess of other things going on. Like you said, this factory farming, just the sheer massiveness of the whole thing is scary. When you get into, you don't even need to get into the fact that some are turning up mutilated. If you just talk about the strangeness of what the hell's going on with cattle, and it's like, whoa, this is some frightening stuff. Now, just to sort of put a bow on the evolution of all this, as we've talked about it, the 67 was snippy, and then sort of went, there was this sort of like pig disappearance, as you're saying, and it went dormant for a little while, then it exploded in the 70s through the early 80s. I guess what doused the fire of cattle mutilations in the mainstream? How come? Because nowadays, like you said, no one really talks about it anymore, and we don't hear much about it anymore. So what happened?
How about three words? Linda Moulton Howe.
Okay.
And the whole alien agenda. This is all aliens coming down, gathering genetic material. That gave it the giggle factor that the media required in order to not take it seriously. If we say that these cows are being predated upon and cut up by aliens, then how can you take this thing seriously? That is, if you really want my honest to God, unvarnished opinion, that's what happened. And when people say, well, Well, it's obviously, you know, cattle mutilations. Yeah. Well, it's aliens, right? It's like, well, yeah, that's what you've been, you know, programmed with that information for the last, since 1989, when Alien Harvest, the only real proponent book about the validity of the mystery, that's the only book that really has come out, and it was privately published and not many copies were sold. You know, the Rommel report in 1980 debunked the whole thing when Kenneth Rommel, a retired FBI bank robber expert, was paid $50,000 by the district attorney of Santa Fe, Northern New Mexico district, to do a study of the cattle mutilations, because so many were happening in New Mexico. And Harrison Schmitt, the last man to walk on the moon, was being petitioned by the ranching community to do something about it. So we have Kenneth Rommel running around the end of 79 into the beginning of 1980 trying to study the phenomenon and do testing on about 80-something animals. Unfortunately, the mutilations weren't going on that particular time period in New Mexico. They switched completely and went to Canada and parts of the upper Midwest and the Rocky Mountain states. So basically what he was doing is running around, you know, visiting scared ranchers who were reporting animals mutilated, and, you know, probably the vast majority of them, except for 14, which they couldn't really, they said, yeah, there may be something here. But the rest of them were all just mundane scavenger action. A vast majority of cases, once the media gets involved, are mundane scavenger cases. I'll be the first to admit that the debunkers were right up to a certain point. And if Kenneth Rommel was going around testing cases that weren't high strange, that didn't have, you know, scalpel, you know, cut hair follicles, the types of things that the investigators look for in the field, obviously he's going to debunk the whole thing. And just like, you know, Edward Condon did in the Condon report for UFOs in 67 through 69, Condon actually investigated the Snippy case, by the way. Most people know that.
Yeah, I was just going to draw the comparison. It sounds like the Rommel report was the same agenda as the Condon report.
Pretty much. And so if he doesn't have real cases to examine, obviously he's just going to whitewash the whole thing and say there's nothing to see here, folks, move along. So it's a combination of the 1983 book, Nude Evidence, which, again, was looking at a lot of mundane scavenger action. The cases that were real were downplayed in the book, and the cases that were equivocal were highlighted. So you have that. They got, what, $80,000 advance to write the book, and they ended up selling less than 5,000 copies, and they ended up pulping tens of thousands of copies of the book because the publisher wanted some mystery. They wanted, oh, we want aliens. We want a government conspiracy. And when they came up and said, there's nothing to see here, move along, nobody bought the book. So Nude Evidence ended up getting pulped. You know, 60,000 copies, I think, ended up getting pulped. And they ate the $80,000 advance they paid the two writers. So a combination of that, the Rommel report, and then in the interim, Linda Howe getting involved and cherry picking the cases that featured unusual lights, you know, people thinking that aliens were involved, highlighting their testimony. Then you have this plausible deniability that's magnified. You have not only the plausible deniability of debunkers and skeptics, but then you have someone coming in and saying, well, it's all aliens. So that you want to know why it went off the map? That's why. And it's a perfectly designed program of sleight of hand. Let's say it's this, say it's that, and everybody will just not pay attention anymore. But these cases have continued. I personally have investigated or researched over 200 cases from 93 to 2010 was my last case.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of these cases occurring. They're occurring all through the cattle herds in South America. We've had cases in Panama, Nicaragua, Puerto Rico, the Canary Islands, Mexico, Australia, several of the Western European countries, England, Ireland, Scotland. We've had, like I said, dolphin cases. We've had seals. We've had cases, these half-cat cases, which I still don't know what to make of. There's thousands of domesticated cats that have been found cut in half and the rear end's missing. It just defies belief when you really start digging into that information. And I must say, much to her credit, Linda Howe has been one of the only people that has kept the domestic cat mutilation mystery in the forefront of some people's minds. And my hat's off to her. Linda's a tireless worker. She trained me to be an interviewer, helped me train as a field investigator. I owe her a lot of thanks and gratitude for all the hard work that she's done. I just disagree with her opinion that it's aliens gathering genetic material to hybridize their race or for whatever purpose. I tell people, they say, well, it's all aliens, right? And I say, well, wait a minute. If aliens were coming down to gather genetic material, why wouldn't they pick the lock on a rendering plant or an abattoir and go in and get as much genetic material as they needed? Why sneak around in cattle herds out in the dark? It doesn't make any sense. So I think it's a location-specific phenomenon. It's not necessarily the cow. It's where the cow is in the environment. And that's, I think, a major clue right there.
Interesting, interesting. So you're saying it's just a major, that's really intriguing. I have to take a moment here to think about that. Environmentally specific. So they're more interested in sort of where the cattle is hanging around, for lack of a better term, or it's some kind of phenomenon that just lends itself to that area.
Location, location, location. If you go in the United States, as an example, downwind and downstream of where we have nuclear power plants, uranium mines, weapons enrichment facilities, anywhere we futz around with nuclear materials, missile fields, air bases with nuclear armed wings, SAC command and control scenarios with nuclear materials. If you go downwind and downstream of those locations, those are the highest areas of incidence of cattle mutilations, statistically speaking. And there's new studies coming out that suggest that prion disease may be somehow kicked off easier if a animal is exposed to environmental radiation. So you have the double whammy of downwind, downstream of nuclear plants and downwind and downstream of outbreaks of chronic wasting disease and other types of TSEs, for instance, in the environment. You know, I'm giving a Cliff Notes version here. I'm kind of stating things generally here. I go into much greater detail, obviously, in the book. But
of course,
there seems to be a relationship between radiation and the onset of full-blown symptomatic TSE, and the environmental location of these animals. This does not completely hold true around the world, but in North America, which is the epicenter pretty much of this mystery, we do see some very, very intriguing trends, patterns, and we can look at them and start to come up with some pretty, I think, solid analysis. There's Kevin Randall, your friend Paul Kimball. There's been a number of investigators and researchers and thinkers over the years that have just totally dismissed this as a bunch of hysteria. And I find it interesting that the whole idea of occult involvement was started by, guess who? J. Allen Hynek, Jerome Clark, in his own way, in a lesser way, Kevin Randall, back in the early 70s when these first cases started to crop up and they were tied to UFOs. The top people in the field did their very best to separate the UFO phenomenon from cattle mutilations by blaming it on occultists. And I go into great
depth. That's what I was just going to ask you. How did this? Because the last thing I can imagine about the cattle mutilations is somehow it's connected to cults. But that seemed to be one of the, like we said earlier, the big four explanations of possibilities. Cults is in there, and it's like, how did cults even get in there? So you're saying that was caused by people in the UFO field trying to sort of distance the UFO phenomenon from all this?
Exactly, and I can tell you exactly the Typhoid Mary example of this is when J. Allen Hynek suggested to an alcohol, tobacco, and firearms investigator named Donald Flickinger in Minnesota, some of the earliest cases that we know in the 70s happened in Minnesota, around the Minneapolis area there, and he suggested to Flickinger that he should look into a particular claim by a Texas criminal. Actually, there were two of them, Dugan and Bankston. Look into their claims that they knew that cult groups were involved and to study this. And what happened was that Flickinger sent out a memorandum to all the sheriff's departments in the country saying, hey, there may be occult activity in your town, and they may be predating on cattle and other animals. So keep your eye open for this. And then once you get law enforcement agencies with that, you know, with that bug in their in their suit, then you know the media is going to be talking to these cops, and then you find headlines, you know, occultists blame for cattle mutilation, Satanists, you know, we're seeing neuroscience, and we have a bunch of really cool cases that feature hooded figures, ritual sign, animals, you know, that are found in locations where, you know, apparent occult activity is taking place. There's some really good cases in Montana, cases in Idaho, cases in Colorado. In one case in Idaho, there was a group of 15 to 20 hooded figures that were actually linking arm in arm and stopping traffic so people couldn't travel on a state highway, and then mutilations were discovered. So cases in Iowa where, you know, abandoned houses were filled with ritual altars with cow skulls and candles and writings on the wall. And of course, it's difficult for law enforcement to investigate a claim of a cattle mutilation and also have this weird kind of occult activity crop up and not, you know, link the two. So there's this accidental sort of attribution to occult phenomena. But I think at its core, there is an aspect of ritual blood sacrifice going on here. I'm not discounting the occult theory by any stretch. And I'm one of the few people that thinks that it's even plausible that there may be some sort of ritual magic connection. Why do humans sacrifice animals to the gods? And why have we done that for tens of thousands of years? You know, there's got to be a reason. Maybe the gods come down and take the good animals. So let's sacrifice some, you know, mediocre animals, and maybe they won't come down and take the good ones. You know?
Yeah. Like if we sacrifice the cattle, they won't come for us.
Well, that's taking a big leap. We won't even talk about human mutilations yet because there's really not much to talk about in that particular
end human mutilation seems I don't know if that's a growing industry or if it's something that's kind of urban legend at this point. I don't know yet. But well, that's
there are some. There are some.
Yeah, I agree with that. I just mean, you know, I don't think it's an epidemic.
No, it's the most covered up type of crime that you'll ever encounter in a law enforcement agency.
How so?
They don't want to talk about it. I have run into brick walls. I've known of a couple of cases, exhausted all efforts to dig into it, and was literally told, do not push me on this. Do not ask me about this. Do not. I can neither confirm or deny that you've even talked to me about this. You know, and Don Ecker is an ex-law enforcement officer from Pennsylvania. And, you know, when he attempted to look into this because of some cases he became aware of, he was met with a total brick wall. And he's kind of like an insider guy in law enforcement. At least he was back, you know, in the day when he was doing this in the 80s. So, you know, there have been a few cases that have been touted over the years, the White Sands mutilation case of the airman. There was a number of cases up in Idaho that are very intriguing, that there's enough, I think, evidence to suggest that there were some real cases there. I had a case that was told to me confidentially about a young girl in Silver City, New Mexico. I absolutely was unable to get any sort of traction, investigative traction to look into that. The San Carlos Indian Reservation, Arizona, there was supposedly a mutilation case or two or three possibly, complete, you know, stonewall on that. You know, the Guiraparanga Reservoir case, of course, you know, some of your listeners, I'm sure, have seen these horrendous autopsy photos of a guy that was found mutilated on a reservoir outside of in Brazil. All the upper respiratory organs in the heart were pulled out, a small hole in the crook of his elbow. All the lower organs were pulled out, a small hole in his belly button. His genitalia was enlarged. Usually they cut it off. In this case, it was the opposite. Mandible was excised, tongue was taken, you know, and then we have a complete autopsy report, you know, five or six very gruesome photographs that are out there on the net, you know, if anybody wants to go out and look at them, which I don't recommend. So, you know, there is some kind of hint of evidence of these types of things happening, but if you really want to know about human mutilations, all you have to do is go to Africa. They happen there all the time, and that's because people are suspected of witchcraft, and they, you know, they do terrible things to each other on the dark continent, and you know, from time to time.
Not to paint too broad a brush here, but these human mutilations. So these are instances where people turn up mysteriously, with characteristics similar to the cattle mutilations, where soft tissue
Correct.
Parts are taken and stuff like that.
Right. The organs that most often become cancerous in mammals, especially in humans. The soft tissue organ areas where we develop cancer are the organs that are usually reported as missing in the classic mutilation scenario. I find that that's not by accident. Another thing that I find very intriguing, too, is that humans are almost an identical genetic match to human hemoglobin, to cattle hemoglobin. If you're a universal donor, you can survive a transfusion of cattle hemoglobin in an emergency situation. In fact, it's been used in wartime. They use cattle hemoglobin to supplement blood loss. Cattle's blood is a genetic match 99.9 to nine places, 99999999 to humans. Pigs are to seven places. It's the old adage, you are what you eat. We've been eating cattle for so long that our blood and hemoglobin is almost a virtual match. Which I don't think is by accident, and I think that that has some bearing and some relevance to the discussion. You know, I really try to look at all the extenuating circumstances. I try to look at connecting points, at patterns, at scientific fact, how that may somehow play a part in this scenario. If we are able to determine X, Y, and Z, doesn't that suggest a particular pattern or answer? So I'm looking at this as not only a medical mystery and a criminal or crime mystery or a paranormal mystery, but I'm also looking at it as a cultural mystery. We are in complete denial about cattle as a protein source in our diet, and it's really an important issue that will have to be dealt with sooner or later because of the detrimental impact that cattle have on human health and on the planet's environment. And we like the convenience of pulling into a fast food restaurant, pulling up to the drive-in window, paying a couple, $3 for a hamburger, and going on our way. We don't want to know about ammonia slime that's used to kill bacteria and is in the burgers. We don't want to know that only 12% of that burger is actually meat. We don't want to know that up to 1,000 different animals can be represented in a single fast food hamburger. These are the types of cultural blind spots that are all inexorably linked to this cattle mutilation phenomenon. I'm convinced of that.
Yeah. Well, it's a tricky subject because, you know, like we were talking about, you get the cattle part and then you got the cattle mutilations part. There's two different separate things. You wonder why, you wonder where it's all heading, I guess, is the thing. I'm concerned about it all. Well, I wanted to ask you, too, this sort of draws upon what you were saying earlier, where you said in the mid-70s, sort of when this thing really exploded, since then the consumption of beef has been cut in half. Was there any sort of, I'm going to draw a parallel here, I guess, to the old theory that, you know, the government's, like, seeding UFO information into the media to change people's thoughts about aliens and stuff like that. Was there any sort of concerted campaign by the government to get people to stop eating as much beef since 75, and that's why we have half the beef consumption?
Well, you know, I don't really think so. I think it's just education. We pump cattle full of grain so that they get fat. And that fat, that marbling in the meat is what is, you know, if you have a nice juicy steak, it's juicy because it's got these big globules of fat in it. Fat is not the best thing to consume for various health reasons. Obviously, your cardiovascular system can be compromised by too much cholesterol, too much fatty, elements in the blood, and plaque building up on arteries, that sort of thing. I think as people become more health conscious, I think that has pulled back a little bit on people's beef consumption. But the beef industry has done everything in its power to combat that. If anything, the beef industry is trying to keep the consumption of beef as high as possible. Beef is the largest income-producing sector of the agricultural business, of agriculture, okay? It mm-hmm. generates more dollars than anything else. For instance, McDonald's utilizes about 1 billion pounds of beef a year. Now, it's a huge income-producing sector of the economy. We've been exporting beef. We've been importing beef. A lot of the fast food companies now are raising beef away from the United States. So that figure of the amount of head of livestock in the United States being halved is largely due because a lot of it's been farmed out. And we're buying beef from Australia, we're buying beef from South America, and they're cutting down the rainforest to make more room for cattle, which is really a problem, okay, for the environment. The lungs of our planet are being compromised because of cattle, okay? I mean, just look at how much gas a single head of livestock produces. They belch or fart once every minute and a half, 2 minutes. All that methane, tons, millions of tons of methane, are an ozone-depleting gas. They're the second largest natural producer of ozone-depleting gases. Termites, believe it or not, are the largest producer of methane on the planet. Cattle are a close second. So the beef industry is really doing the opposite. They're attempting to keep in place subsidies for beef. If you paid the actual amount of money it would cost to bring that quarter pounder to your fast food restaurant, it would be like the same price of a hamburger in Japan. It would be like $10, $12. The beef industry is coddled. They're protected. They're subsidized. The beef lobby is one of the largest political powers in this country. When the Sherman Antitrust Act was proposed in the late 1890s, people think it was done to break up the railroads, to break up Standard Oil, to break up, J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller type, organizations and companies that were around at the time gobbling up competition. No, the Sherman Antitrust Act was built to break up the beef trust, and it didn't work. The beef trust was so powerful. Cudahy, Armour, all these huge beef concerns in Chicago where all the beef was being processed. They were able to combat the legislation for 12 years, and it wasn't until the very famous book, The Jungle, came out by Upton Sinclair, which totally did an expose on the conditions within the slaughtering houses where people would, not report clock out of work, and then where'd the guy go? And nobody knew, and he probably ended up in a vat of lard and got processed, and child labor. Upton Sinclair's book was required reading. It was for me in high school, and a lot of people were outraged by the unsanitary conditions, by the exploitation of workers, and the total stranglehold of the five big beef companies. And so when the book came out, then boom, the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed. The beef industry took a hit, but boy, I tell you, they've been on the rebound ever since. I eat beef. I suggest that everybody eat beef. I'm not Oprah here. I'm not saying don't eat beef. I'm saying be very selective. Don't eat as much, maybe. Make sure you know where it comes from. Make sure it's grass-fed. If you live in a rural area, make sure it's local. And processed meat is a really, really bad thing for your health. Processed meat, okay? If there's sodium nitrates, if there's, all these additives in there, preservatives, growth hormones, antibiotics, these types of things are a real major health issue in this country that is not being addressed by the mainstream.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I guess what I had been suggesting maybe was not that the beef industry would be in on any sort of like agenda to lessen beef consumption, but just that the government would kind of be easing people off of beef to stave off whatever they discovered possibly in the 70s that caused the cattle mutilation study, let's say, if we're going with that kind of idea. But
well, maybe.
I want to pip.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that's all, because I don't expect the beef industry to work. You know, it's kind of like like cigarettes with the government. You know, they don't want people to smoke cigarettes. Maybe they kind of just sort of easing people away from beef or something. I was asking if you saw any trend like that.
Well, until the beef subsidies, are lifted, no, I don't see that.
Okay.
As soon as we pay the amount of money that it costs to produce that pound of beef, let's say, I mean, 1,700 pounds of grain are fed a single calf to get it to that 450 or so pound weight so it can be rendered and processed. That amount of grain, if you added up all the grain that we feed cattle, we could be feeding all 2.2 billion starving people on this planet. Just from the cattle in this country that we fatten up with grain. If we use that grain to feed the world, we wouldn't have starving people on this planet.
That's crazy. I don't know. That's just crazy. Like, why, what is wrong with our species that we that we're so off track that we don't want to utilize that? That's crazy.
It's the beef eaters. Look at it. I mean, in England, you know, beef became a status symbol. And that's where the beef eaters come from. Beef eater gin, the beef eaters in England. I mean, that they came about for a very specific reason. If you were wealthy and affluent, you could afford to eat beef because you had to pay the price that it cost to produce it. Okay, that was back in the Middle Ages. You know, the 16th, 17th, 18th century we're talking about here. Now, countries around the world are trying to gain affluence. They're trying to move from the third world into the second world, move from the second world into a cutting edge first world kind of civilization or culture. And what is one of the hallmarks of affluence in a country is to be able to go out and eat a steak.
Yeah.
How many countries around the world are aspiring to be affluent and be able to go out and afford to eat a steak? I mean, that's one of the major signs of, hey, I've arrived. I am an affluent, upwardly mobile, individual. It doesn't matter if you're in Nairobi, if you're in Korea, if you're in, Papua New Guinea. If you can afford to go out and eat a steak, then, you got it on the ball. So
yeah,
that
culture, that's so bizarre.
Think about it, think about it. If you can afford to eat beef, that means that you are better than X amount of people. Okay, they can't afford to eat it, but you can. So there's this cultural kind of underpinnings here that are never addressed when you're talking about cattle mutilations. When you're talking about cattle as a protein source, people don't look at the cultural motivations, the ramifications of the act of eating beef. I mean, beef is it's a status symbol. And, beef, it's what's for dinner, as old Robert Mitchum, I think, was the first one.
You're right. It's just crazy that, like I said, what's wrong with our society? You think people would wake up and be like, well, we really have our priorities in a messed up place. But what now, in all these sort of fields of endeavor, especially ufology and stuff, you get the whistleblowers. Have there been any sort of whistleblowers or shadowy folks who have sort of spoken out from behind the scenes who are like, hey, I was mixed up in all that cattle mutilation stuff in the 70s. Here's what really happened. Do you know of any stories like that?
There are some, and they're not well documented. I'm the kind of person that likes to rely on data. Rely on stuff that I can demonstrably present and prove. So coming from that particular angle, no, there's little, if any, information. But I have been told stories by reputable people. In one case, it was by a the head investigator for five counties for the DA's office in a Colorado district. He was suffering the influx of gang activity into his district. And so the DA said, look, we don't know what this graffiti means. We don't know what the gang sign stuff is. We're a rural community. All of a sudden we're having to deal with this stuff. Since you're the lead investigator, there's a seminar in Colorado Springs. I want you to go to it and learn all you can about gangs and about, you know, their rituals and their initiation rites and all that sort of thing. So he went to a workshop for law enforcement officials that was put on by a very famous investigator who was featured actually in a Hollywood movie in terms of occult sign and gang activity. He was an expert in that sort of ritualized cultural behavior. And so, you know, he went through the first day of the workshop, and at lunch, he was having lunch with some of the guys, and the instructor sat down and started talking to him and asked him where he was from, and he said, I'm from the San Luis Valley. He goes, oh, San Luis Valley, Snippy the Horse, cattle mutilations out there. I know about that. In fact, I was asked to come to D.C. and testify behind closed doors in a secret subcommittee or some sort of committee meeting. And they were aware of a ritual occult group within the government that had access to military technology, and they were going out and doing cattle mutilations as a ritual response to whatever is out there mutilating cattle. Check that out. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute, what are you telling me? And he said, that's what he told me. And, who am I to, say the guy's lying? I don't know. I didn't ask him to tell me anything. He just blurted that out. So it does appear that there is at least some sort of knowledge on some level, theoretically, in government, that there are some sort of government, there is a government group that's somehow involved in going out and responding or reacting to mutilation cases by doing their own, but in a ritual manner. And I find that very intriguing, because that brings in this whole element of ritual blood sacrifice, of kind of a weird sort of quasi-pseudo-occult angle, which I've always felt was involved on some level at the core of this phenomenon. It's almost like, maybe the true high strange cases are perpetrated by some sort of as yet undefined or misunderstood predator that has always been living alongside us, that maybe is dimensional or is maybe some sort of occult, a life force that's been brought into being, that maybe the ritual magicians lost control of it and it all of a sudden gained its own agenda, sort of a nasty, bloodthirsty trickster that's now self-aware and has its own agenda. I've heard other cops in law enforcement tell me that it appears the government shows up in helicopters at these cases to shut down some sort of doorway or to close down, terminate some sort of portal, that there's like something that's coming through and they don't have any control of it. And all they can do is react, and they shut it down by doing ritual cases that somehow supplicate it or tell it it's okay, go, leave us alone here, go somewhere else,
Oh,
so,
man.
I mean, there's some angles that are kind of, there's hints of some pretty high strange stuff going on here.
Yeah, dark.
Very dark. Nick Redfern, great book, Final Events. Great book.
Mm-hmm.
The Collins Elite.
Great book, yeah.
A group of individuals that have been monitoring UFO activity and other things because they think it's dark occult energy. That would fit in with this kind of scenario, that there may be some sort of very secret, clandestine, interagency group that's maybe somehow monitoring this and trying to cut it off at the pass, close down, terminate these doorways that are somehow open, that we may be dealing with some sort of, like supernatural predator or some dark occult-based force that maybe was initially brought into being ritualistically and they lost control of it. There's some elements in here that you don't hear Linda Howe talking about. You don't hear Chuck Zukowski talking about. You don't hear, the debunkers even acknowledging that any of this could possibly be even possible. You know?
Yeah, no, so, they don't want anyone to even know about it. The last thing the debunkers were talking about.
No, that's like why, people say, well, do you think UFO disclosure is going to happen? And I say, well, maybe what the government knows on some level, maybe it's very compartmentalized and not many people know, but maybe it is so terrifying and so, horrific that we're being done a favor by not having disclosure. If we knew what was really going on, it would scare, the holy, crap out of us,
Right.
So it may be that way within the unexplained livestock death phenomenon as well. So, you have to look at all this stuff. You have to be able to support your hypothesis with data. You have to be able to replicate it. You have to be able to show patterns. You have to be able to come up with grounded thinking, grounded analysis, grounded investigative work, grounded data that, is beyond, the equivocal nature of most data that is tossed around as fact in this field and in other fields, the paranormal, hauntings, UFOs, psychic phenomena. You really have to have your I's crossed and your T's dotted to be taken seriously in any quasi-proto-scientific endeavor. And that's what I've attempted to do with Stalking the Herd. I've really come up with some cases that cannot be ignored. They cannot be just dissed and just, with a sniff, dismiss it. Oh, that's a bunch of BS. We have world-class veterinary pathologists telling you what's going on. You've got to, sit up and pay attention. Okay, I'm not a veterinary pathologist. I'm an amateur here. I don't know diddly compared to a guy that's got his, it's spent 12 years studying animal, husbandry and then get a degree in pathology. Even a vet, your standard animal vet, doesn't have the education to determine how an animal died and what happened once it died. Vets have been fooled by this. I had a really good case where a vet called me up and said, "You won't believe this. I had a cow mutilated. It was still warm, and when I tried to drag it off to the bone pile, it was so necrotic already, I pulled it apart trying to drag it off. And the thing was, it had just died hours before. We have cases of advanced necrosis. We have cases of retarded necrosis. Animals won't rot. We have cases where, flies, insects land on the animal and die. We have, for instance, a New Mexico livestock brand inspector and livestock officer who investigated a case. And when he pulled the tarp off the animal, he was overcome by a gas that came out. Maybe it was insecticide on the hide. Maybe it was this. Maybe it was that. Well, whatever it was, that mutilated animal made him go into retirement. He was put in the hospital. He had major respiratory issues that forced the end of his career. We have, the initial Snippy the Horse case. They found a piece of meat on a chico bush, in the pasture a few feet away from the animal, and the owner of the horse poked it with a stick and touched the stick and got this acid burn on her hand. We've had cases where people have had burns from touching these animals. Cases where UFOs have been seen in the field. Cases where helicopters have been landed on a road with a guy astride on top of a cow doing something to it. And when the cops arrived, the helicopter that was landed next to the cow with the guy was gone, and so was the cow. And all they left behind was this kind of weird, slick spot on the road. There's a ton of cases that you just can't explain away as being mundane scavengers. Or ETs or government. I mean, it makes your head spin. I'm telling you, it really does.
We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?